It's Behind the Headlines on WLIW. It's our opportunity to sit down on a weekly basis and talk with some of the award-winning journalists who cover what's going on in the East End and do a bit of a deeper dive into the week's news. I'm Joe Shaw. I'm the executive editor of the Express News Group. We publish the Southampton Press, the East Hampton Press, the Sag Harbor Express, the website 27east.com, and Express Magazine. My co-host is Bill Sutton. He's the managing editor of the Express News Group. Good morning, Bill.
Hello, Joe. Hi, everybody.
Good to see everybody. So, good panel this week. We have Beth Young from the East End Beacon. She's the editor of the East End Beacon. Hey, Beth.
Howdy.
We have Denise Civiletti, who's the editor of Riverhead Local. Hey, Denise.
Hey, how you doing?
And we have Alec Lewis, who's a staff writer at Riverhead Local. Hey, Alec.
Hello.
Good to have you. So, I feel like we would be remiss if it's not a local story by any means, but I think we'd be remiss if we don't start the conversation this week with a few seconds about the terrible thing that happened on Wednesday, which was the assassination of Charlie Kirk at a college in Utah. And I think I probably speak for the panel when I say that I think we're all just horrified. Political violence doesn't have any place in American society in any way, shape, or form. And this was a particularly shocking one because really, Charlie Kirk, and I have to say, I've never been a fan of Charlie Kirk's, and I don't agree with a lot of what Charlie Kirk said, but he was a young man. He was only 31. He was a young father with a couple of kids, and all he did for a living was talk, and I think it's very anti-American to use violence against somebody for their ideas, whatever they are. So I don't know if anybody has anything to add. It's a difficult situation for us. I'm not sure any of us is going to cover this locally, are we? Or are we going to see what the local reaction is?
All we do for a living is talk too. So
that's true.
And I was going to say that.
That's exactly the point. I mean, I think it's part of a larger problem, which is that there's just so much violence against people for words. And words are what this country is built on. And
do we know what the motive was for that? I mean, we're assuming that it was political. I don't know that they've necessarily determined that. It seems pretty likely.
It's a fair point.
I don't know if there was some other. I mean,
as we're reporting, we don't even have a suspect.
All gun violence is tragic, and you know, no matter this guy's politics or whatever, it just. You know, anything, any assassination is tragic. Any gun violence, any killing is tragic. And it's unfortunate that while this has gotten some attention, there was, school shooting the same day that didn't get as much attention, and those just keep going. And I don't know what this country is going to do to address gun violence in general. People have different opinions on whether you need to do anything to address gun violence or whether you address, you know, people with the guns, but it just seems like there's a lot of gun violence and it's sad and it's tragic. And, I don't know what the answer is, obviously.
We should mention that we're recording this on Thursday afternoon.
Right.
Yes.
So there might be additional developments about.
Yeah, there's
motive,
no suspect or anything at this point that we know of. And Alec,
well, there is a suspect. They released photos.
Yeah, they did have some photos, but they don't have anybody in custody yet.
Right.
Alec, as the youngest member of the group, I mean, I feel like you've grown up in a time that's been, you know, there's been a swing back and forth in this country between administrations, between political philosophies. And we've really run into a real violent time, and I wonder what your perspective is as a younger person.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely scary. You have people like, well, you know, Charlie Kirk was a right-wing media personality, but then you had kind of, I don't want to say the left-wing version of Charlie Kirk, but, you know, somebody from the left wing, Hassan Piker, who was live streaming while this was happening, reporting on this, a left-wing commentator saying, you know, to his audience who were kind of making jokes about Charlie Kirk and him being shot, you know, don't do this. This is extremely serious. You know, we have, you know, this could happen to me. And you know, him being a left-wing commentator, that this violence might, you know, expand beyond, it's beyond politics. And for journalists, it's beyond, any sort of politics. I mean, we try our hardest to be fair and accurate and fairly represent all sides of an issue. And despite that, the death of journalists just keep increasing. I mean, you look back, I guess maybe it was a week and a half ago now, in Gaza, where well, a lot of journalists aren't even allowed there in Gaza, but the few journalists that are there and that are reporting and they're reporting on a bombing, a missile attack on a hospital, and then they were attacked again. A missile struck the same position and ended up killing, I think it was 20 people, including 8 journalists who were reporting on the issue. So this violence extends not just in the United States of America, but across the world. And journalists have been subjects of violence during wars for a long time. And it actually last year, I just looked up the statistics, actually last year was there were 124 deaths for journalists and media workers in 2024, and that's the new record. There was 113 killed in 2007. This is based on the Committee to Protect Journalists, which is a organization that tracks these kinds of things, and they began collecting data on this 3 decades ago. And it's scary for somebody like me who's getting into the industry and anybody who's talking about this. I mean, we get how many times do people come to a Facebook comment section on our article or something like that and maybe try to say that, oh, this isn't true, they're a rag. It feeds into this environment that led, unfortunately, I think, to the death of Charlie Kirk.
I think violence begets violence. There's no question about it. And I think that's the scariest part about this. And I spoke with a conservative friend of mine who said, who said, he's seen things about people on the left celebrating this. And I said, I have not spoken to a single person who has thought this is anything but an awful tragedy and an awful moment for America. And I'm sure if you go on social media, look, if you go on social media, you can find ugliness on all sides. And I don't think that's who we are as a nation. And I think we should move on to some more local topics because this is obviously a conversation that's happening at a national level right now.
I just want to say, I hope and pray it doesn't become a local conversation and a local topic, because I feel like in so many ways our country, our civilization is kind of like a tinderbox. And this kind of thing can erupt anywhere, really. I
One of
mean,
the things I'm really proudest of about my colleagues on the East
yeah.
End is that we do host a lot of conversations with a lot of people from a lot of different points of view. And I think that's really helpful. I think it's a balm for this time. I think it gives people a voice. And when you give people a voice and they feel like they're being heard, they don't have to yell. And we try very hard to do that for all sides. Whether I agree or disagree, I think it's important to listen to people.
I agree.
So maybe
And
we leave it.
it's important to speak with kindness and empathy, I mean, I feel like we've lost that. Not we in particular, this group of people, but just in general.
So much of the.
Everybody's, just mouthing off about things right away, when they don't even know the first thing about what even happened,
And
whether
so much of
that's,
it is about us and them all of the
yeah.
time as a country. And we just had, today, the day we're recording is the anniversary of 9/11. And I was talking with another friend who said, it's kind of morbid to say that I miss the moments of togetherness we felt as a country after that event. It was an awful, horrible event. But we all really did come together for a little while after 9/11. And that may have been the last moment when that was true.
I attended a prayer service this morning that Riverhead Town officials did. Assemblywoman Jody Giglio was there, and that was a point that Supervisor Tim Hubbard made, and as well as Assemblywoman Giglio, that let's try to get back to that point where we were unified and that, you know, Americans were sort of on the same page about, you know, defending our country and defending our democracy from any threat to us, mm-hmm. to our livelihood here.
I disagreed with Charlie Kirk, but Charlie Kirk was a debater, and I think debate is a very American thing, and disagreement is an American thing. We have to get back to those principles, I think, in this country. But let's move on and talk about some local topics. Beth, we wanted to talk about two projects that are happening in two different communities that involve dredging, which is a fairly significant topic for the maritime communities out here. If you want to talk a little bit about it, I know that we had a story this week about a project in Montauk. There's also a project going on in Matatuck. Can you talk a little bit about Matatuck first?
Well, it's actually not going on, which is the news. What happened in Montauk, basically, they were going to do this big dredging project. They are going to do this big dredging project that they did an emergency dredging back in February to dredge.
Army Corps of Engineers.
Yeah, the Army Corps to dredge it to 12 feet, and they got high bids coming into the fall dredging, and informed the town earlier this week that they wouldn't go through with it unless they came up with $1.1 million. So the town used money from its offshore wind farm.
An additional 1.1, right? I mean, the town was already committed to a couple million or over a million already.
Yeah, I think 1.5.
Right.
So the town is touting this as, you know, the wind farm helping the fishing community. The fishing community still has a lot of reservations about all of this. And Nick LaLotta's office was telling me they were still looking for the money, but what the town had heard was that September 10th was the drop dead date. So the town put the money in. The project is going to go forward. Up in Matatuck, the Army Corps of Engineers was also going to dredge Matatuck Inlet, which is also, it's the only navigable waterway on the North Fork. I think the next one is like Port Jefferson, maybe. So this whole swath of Long Island, the only access to a port is in Matatuck Inlet until you get from the Long Island Sound until you get to Port Jefferson.
And we should explain to people that these inlets, they get shoaling, it's called, right? Where the bottom gets built up and needs to be dredged out again because the problem is a lot of the vessels are having trouble getting in and out the inlets.
Right. Yeah. There are a lot of shoals in front of Matatuck Inlet too. That was the problem in Montauk.
Mm-hmm.
And also in Matatuck, you know, there are two very large jetties that the Army Corps placed there over 100 years ago now. And so one side of the jetty has a whole bunch of sand that actually overshoots the jetty and ends up shoaling the inlet. And then the other side is starved of sand. And the inlet makes a sharp turn toward the starved side when it comes in. So this beach is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And all that's holding is this like dune restoration project there that's keeping it from the waves from storms from coming in. Actually,
kind of interesting. It's kind of a self-created problem with the jetties, right? I mean, the jetties were put there to keep the inlets clear, but they also disrupt the flow of sand, the sand migration.
Yeah. So the Army Corps did a very big dredging back in 2014 that placed all the sand on the side that it was accreting on the starved side, but it's all gone at this point. Mm-hmm. And they were initially, when the Army Corps initially looked at this, they said, I believe it's like every 7 to 10 years, I could be wrong on the dates, that they would need to keep doing this degree of dredging. Now, the project they were going to do this fall actually was just for navigation purposes. So there's navigation dredging, and then there's dredging that also, it's called Section 111 dredging, which is a bigger project that encompasses the environmental damage caused by their infrastructure there, which is the jetties. So they were just going to do the navigation dredging this fall, and that was rescheduled to the following fall because the dredge is inoperable this year. Mm-hmm. So that's in flux. The Army Corps has assured Southold that it will be done next year. But as far as doing the bigger project, which the Army Corps itself initially said needed to be done, that's still in limbo. The Matatuck Park District owns the property on either side of this inlet. So they're They're very concerned about it. They're having a big community meeting. Actually, the Mattituck Laurels Civic Association is having a big community meeting on that on October 6th. I believe it's at Veterans Beach on Peconic Bay Boulevard.
Does Southhold have to share in the cost of that dredging?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question.
I thought it was interesting in Montauk that East Hampton was able to utilize wind farm money, money that was paid to the town over a series of $29 million over 25 years to help offset the lines, the power lines coming in from the wind farms into East Hampton. And that was kind of those funds were put in place to kind of ease concerns from, you know, the fishing community and other community members. And that money was kind of sitting in a pot right now. And when the Army Corps came in and said the town would have to come up with this extra $1.1 million, the money was there and they were able to use it. And I think that's probably exactly what the point of that money was, is that it would be there for situations like this, which is going to help, the commercial fleet.
But it's also unusual that it was there, because it was there only because of this agreement.
Right.
Yeah, that agreement had initially been a lot less money. And Orsted wants to renegotiate it now.
Yeah, it gave the town a pool of money that they could hurriedly turn around and put towards this project too, which they may not have been able to do otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah, this time of year with the dredging projects, they are very significant, aren't they, for all of the as I said, the maritime community really needs these projects, right?
Yeah, and the window in which dredging can take place is just getting shorter and shorter. You used to be able to do it a bit in the spring, and it's now from October 15th to January 15th to protect flounder that are spawning in the spring, which is another sad story.
Okay, yeah, the flounders. And so let's move on to a more positive story. First, I'll tell everybody, this is Behind the Headlines on WLIW. I'm Joe Shaw. My co-host is Bill Sutton. We're with the Express News Group. Our panelists are Beth Young of the East End Beacon and Denise Civiletti and Alec Lewis from Riverhead Local. Let's talk a little bit about Osprey, which we've talked about before on the show. It's a real success story on the East End. We don't have a lot of those necessarily environmentally, but it truly is one of the great success stories. And we got an update this week that showed, Beth, well, what did it show? It actually showed two things that to me were kind of in opposition to each other. One seemed like a really good thing and the other didn't seem as good.
Well, the group for the East End was very instrumental, back in the 60s and prior to that, DDT had destroyed the eggs of a lot of raptors, bald eagles, ospreys, all these large birds. And it was, Suffolk County was actually the first county to ban it, but the ospreys were pretty much on the brink of extinction at the time. The group for the East End was one of the organizations that at the very beginning was like putting up poles for the ospreys to nest on and doing monitoring of the nesting pairs. So the populations recovered dramatically, and the group for the East End had been doing an annual census of the ospreys in the late 2010s to early 2020s, and they stopped doing it for 3 years because the population was really healthy, and they said, we're going to do it again every 3 years from here on in. Mm-hmm. So this is they did in 2022, they did it again this year, and they found about the same number of nesting pairs, but fewer fledglings. So fewer babies that are leaving the nest this month.
There were actually more nests, though, too, right?
Right.
Yeah. I think that was the case. And I thought that was kind of interesting that more nests but fewer fledglings, and those things don't seem to go together.
But quite a lot. I mean, it was a 65% decrease in the fledglings, but they didn't seem that concerned about that. I mean, that seemed kind of dramatic to me.
Yeah, Beth, did they talk about what the possible cause would have been?
Well, we did have several nor'easters in the spring, which I think might have contributed to some problems with the nest. Predation is always an issue. One of the things that the group for Jen Skilbred from the Group for the East End was talking about was they're nesting in more natural sites now, where they're actually more exposed to predators than on the man-made poles. So
there's more bald eagles around.
Yeah, there's more bald eagles. I think owls also. Yeah. And one of the things she was saying was that we don't really know the carrying capacity of this ecosystem for the ospreys. And, you know, what this really does is just highlight that monitoring is important and seeing these long-term trends is...
Question of also, if I remember, question about availability of food.
Right.
Because of declining fish populations too.
Yeah. Which is interesting. Yeah, that's another element of this.
Changed. Yeah.
I think the decrease
number was not alarming. It was just, a decrease from the last.
Yeah, it was 505 last time and 386 this time.
It's still
is still much healthier than it was 20 years ago.
Well, sure.
But now talk about, you said carrying capacity, Beth. What does that phrase mean?
It kind of means what the ecosystem can support. So what the food can support, what the nesting site, how many nesting sites are there? There wasn't really a lot of data on ospreys prior to their near
resurgence. Prior to their near extinction. Yeah.
Yeah, and the ecosystem was different then, right? There was much less development on the East End prior to this. So, how do you compare what it was before to what it is now? There were maybe other predators back then that played a role that they don't anymore. Every year we have more data on everything in the world, right?
The possibility of a second batch of eggs being laid, like a second fledge, basically, later on. So,
they lay their eggs sequentially. So if they lose the first couple, they can have some more.
It suggests that the predator population may be increasing as well and may be healthy and... That suggests a healthy ecosystem in general, right? I mean, that's the way the ecosystem works. You have more things on a different level of the food chain. And Denise, you mentioned it. The food chain starts with the fish. And if the fish are in decline, that has a ripple effect going up as well.
And again, there were hardly any bald eagles. It wasn't that long ago when everybody was remarking on the first pair of nesting bald eagles around here, and now they're a pretty common sight over the course of the last decade maybe. So
are the bald eagles all over the East End at this point? Do you have them on the North Fork up in Riverhead? And because I know we have quite a few out this way.
We definitely have them in Riverhead. I mean, they've been seen around the Peconic
and that's sort of a side benefit to the osprey population, right? I mean, it wasn't necessarily the goal of the effort, but those are very similar predator type animals, right? And so
they compete for food sources.
They do, yes. But it's interesting that they have increased as well. So it means the entire ecosystem's gotten a lot healthier.
Sure.
Yeah. So some good news for a change. That's always good to hear. Let's switch gears and go up to Riverhead and talk about the Town Square project. Alec, there's been some news this past week about the town taking over one of the properties there for a purpose. You want to fill us in on what's going on? Tell us a little bit about what the Town Square project is first, and then tell us what the new development is.
Yeah, so a few years ago, the town bought up three buildings across from the Suffolk Theater and on Main Street in Riverhead. And it decided it wanted to, it was part of a project that they wanted to do, a public space project called Town Square. It would be a centerpiece for the town's downtown revitalization initiative. Try to bring tourism to the town, try to bring business, try to increase the tax base, and make the downtown a livable, walkable, kind of eat, work, play space, a more mixed-use space akin to places you see out here like Patchogue and other spaces out west. So with those three buildings, the town demolished two of them, probably the most blighted ones, directly across from the Suffolk Theater, but they kept the third one up. And that one has the bar Crafted. there, and it's a popular downtown Riverhead bar. It's one of the only places in Riverhead open really late. It stays open till midnight on pretty much every night, and then at 2 o'clock on weekends. So it's really a place for nightlife. But that building, the town is in contract to sell to a developer, Jay Petroselli, who developed the Long Island Aquarium. He developed the Hyatt Place hotel there and the Sea Star Ballroom. And he's also one of the principals of the company, Joe Petroselli. He's also renovated other historic properties in Riverhead, made them office buildings, the Preston House Hotel, which is across from the aquarium. He's also responsible for that project. So the town and Petroselli want that building to be demolished, the building with Crafton in it. And he's proposing to build a 5-story boutique hotel with other uses too, like a restaurant, retail space. And then the 5th floor of the building is going to be condominiums that he would be able to sell. So this week, actually, and a few weeks ago, the town has been trying to, actually for a few months, acquire the lease of Crafted, which is the building, I mean, the business in there. So they have a lease agreement.
A little controversy about that, though.
Yeah, right? I was going to ask, how did the business owners feel about that?
They didn't like it. They had an agreement prior to the town owning the building there, and they could have actually extended their lease under the terms of their agreement with the previous owner until 2033. So they had plenty of time with their lease. That lease had been entered into in 2019, I believe, 2018, 2019, at a pretty good rate. There was a steady increase for the rent that they felt really comfortable with. And
they've raised concerns that if they have to move, they're not going to be able to afford different space, right?
So what they've been saying is they've been trying to look for a place to relocate. They've said that before, but the rents in downtown Riverhead have been very high for businesses like that. So Crafted announced a few weeks ago on August 28th that they would be closing on September 20th. And that was because the day before that, a state Supreme Court judge granted the town's petition to acquire the leasehold interest of Crafted's operating entity, and pursuant to the eminent domain action that the town had started back in April. So they acquired the leasehold interest. Crafted said, well, we got to shut down now. And so they're doing an event on September 20th, a Drink the Bar Dry event where they'll have drink specials, buffet, that sort of thing, and sort of dance the night away. They got to be out of the building by September 30th.
Denise, let me ask you, can I go and ask Denise a little bit about the history here? It seems pretty aggressive for Riverhead to be taking, you know, using eminent domain to take over the lease of an active business to hand it over to another business. Can you put some of this into some context?
Well, I mean, it is an aggressive move. You know, it's a taking of private property, essentially a lease is private property asset, but it's also something that is allowed by the law. And if you make the case for it and the judge grants your petition, you've got to pay essentially what the judge determines to be fair market value. Now, in this case, they reached a settlement with him post-judgment, right, Alec? They settled
They said, my understanding is they settled it outside of court, but if it wasn't settled outside of court, they could have settled the just compensation portion inside of the court.
Yeah, that's the second part of the proceeding. And
be clear, the business gets the benefit there, right? They have to settle with the business that's losing the lease in the property.
Yeah, they're basically buying out their lease, but it's not, you know, consensual for the business.
I see.
So the town, what happened this week is it was revealed, we ended up reporting that the town is paying $170,000 to acquire
the leasehold
to provide the just compensation required for eminent domain. So
Absent that, it should be noted that there's the loss requires appraisals to be done. And then the judge looking at the appraisals will determine the value of, in this case, it's a lease. Most often it's the value of real property, you know, as opposed to something like a leasehold. But it's the same principle. And rather than go through all of that in court, they reached a settlement agreement with this lease with the business owner.
Denise, there seem to be a lot of moving parts for the Town Square project. How far back does it date? And do they have any kind of timetable about when they hope to have all of this done?
Well, I mean, it was first introduced when the Long Island Science Center announced that it was purchasing a building that is now adjacent to the Town Square property immediately on its west. And that's when the concept of the Town Square first got sort of rolled out with any kind of specificity. And that was, I think, in 2021. And then in 2022, the town purchased those three properties that Alec just referenced that lie between what's the future home of the Science Center, everyone hopes, and the East End Arts Council Gallery building on East Main Street. One of them was really derelict, and that was the first one that was demolished. And then the other one was an unremarkable one-story building, but it was not a derelict building. It wasn't something that was, you know, falling down or anything like that. And it actually had a going business in there. It was a bicycle shop that sold and repaired bicycles. And they demolished that. And the last remaining building was actually a building of substance, an old office building. I actually once looked at office space in there when we were looking to move Riverhead Local. It was a nice old building, but it was out, you know, outmoded kind of. It had three storefronts on the ground floor and a number of offices on the second floor. You know, that's the one that's going to come down next. This is the project that the town, a main part of the project that the town got that $10 million grant for a few years ago.
And they have any kind of timetable for when they hope to have all of this accomplished? Is it going to be a 5-year project or a 10-year project?
It's been ongoing. They've been doing a lot of plans. The town square consists of like what you see from Main Street, but it also goes back to the river. The whole idea is to connect the street with the river. This is roughly opposite the Suffolk Theater. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know how quickly this is going to get done, but you know, Petrocelli is an accomplished builder, and mm-hmm. I'm sure you know that's he's not going to have a problem getting it done. One of the things that he needs to do is actually lift up and relocate by about a foot, I think, the East End Arts Council Gallery building, and that's why the Arts Council is moving to a temporary home in a town-owned building that was part of the campus that the town purchased from Peconic Bay Medical Center, which is located on, it's like a two-story brick building. It used to be the back office operations of Suffolk County National Bank back in the day. And the Arts Council is moving into there. They're moving their offices and stuff in there, and the School of Music, because that's going to all get disrupted with construction. The town is also raising those properties up as a mitigation measure for downtown flooding. Mm-hmm. So those homes are going to be lifted up, and the area behind them is also going to be lifted up. And that's where the plan is to have an amphitheater built back there. That's going to be actually partly for flood mitigation purposes as well.
It's actually a really good idea.
And then behind the what's now the green space and behind the Science Center building are plans for a park for kids, a playground type of park.
This is really transformative. isn't it?
I mean, it's a very big project, and yeah, it will be transformative, and it's got some detractors in town that would like to see that remain kind of like open space as opposed to a playground. But you know, the town has moved deliberately toward getting this done, and they've hired consultants to draw the plans up and revise the plans. And you know, I think that we're at least looking at another couple of years, I think, but I'm just sort of get off the top of my head guessing at that.
And so for the timeline of the hotel specifically, Petrocelli wants that open by June 2027.
Yeah.
And so the kind of what the town officials have been saying to us is that all of this has to sort of be done at the same time, because it's all in the same area. A lot of these things are going on simultaneously. They're all sort of interconnected projects. So probably 2027, 2028, 2029 is when this is really going to start activating. And again, the town got a lot of grant money from the state. You got the $10 million for the Downtown Revitalization Initiative. And that's going towards...
Also, by the way, we don't want to make the impression that that was all going toward this project. That went to a number of other things as well.
Yeah.
I mean, about I think half, a good half of that was going towards some town squared projects.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the RAISE grant, which was the big grant the town got, $25 million from the Federal Department of Transportation. And that's crucial because that's going to pay for most of the parking garage that's going to go behind the Suffolk Theater and make up for a lot of the parking that's being lost by the development of the park there on the riverfront.
Yeah. Lots of moving parts, Joe. Yes.
Big stuff. I mean, Bill, you live in Riverhead.
I like the idea a lot. I think it's going to make downtown a lot more walkable and make it a lot more accessible, and certainly bringing Main Street together with the waterfront, which is something that, you know, until they opened that section up, just wasn't really possible. I think, you know, the waterfront is the advantage, the beauty of downtown, and to bring that together with the business district, I think is really going to.
It's a really interesting idea, because the waterfront is lovely but it is separate from everything that goes on in the town to some degree. So bringing those two together with a project like this has a lot of merit, no question.
So you gotta walk there too. People gotta walk. Go down there. And if there's not a lot of people around walking on the waterfront, really the theory is it could be scary for people because it's really the back of the buildings that have the frontage on Main Street. So it creates that sort of uncomfortability. But with what they're doing with the Petrocelli building is the restaurant is going to be facing the Peconic River. There's going to be more activity there. There's going to be actually an apartment building that's under construction right now, right sandwiched between the East End Arts Council campus and what is another apartment building there on the corner of East Main Street and McDermott Street. And that's also has a restaurant that's overlooking the Peconic River there, the Riverhead Brew House. So creating that activity there, and I think especially the perception that it's safe to walk on the riverfront. I mean, it is. I mean, again, I'm a 6-foot man, so take this with a grain of salt, that I feel safe walking on the Peconic River.
I'm not 6 foot nor male, and I don't feel I have not felt unsafe walking downtown like that, and I can't even.
Yeah, no, it's.
It's
a beautiful stretch.
There are so many people there now. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like it hasn't been desolate for a long time. I mean, and thanks in large part to the town making a directed effort to bring people and make a community downtown again.
But
yeah,
you know, unfortunately, restore that.
Unfortunately, there's still that perception. And yeah, I think that's a lot of what the town's trying to fight right now. And that's a big part of this town square project, is bringing the families down there.
That'll happen.
I also think that bringing the Science Center in to go with the aquarium has a real family-friendly aspect to it. And it's going to turn that part of Riverhead into a real destination for families. And I think that's a wonderful thing. I mean, we don't really have too much of that out here. We've got, you know, some museums and things that are destinations, but I really feel like that's going to turn Riverhead into a major destination for families who are visiting the East End. So
just to add, not a lot of news from the Science Center right now. So
right, yeah. I mean, they talked about a very ambitious timeline to get their first phase up.
And I pass there every day, and there's not a lot of activity. I've been trying to get in touch with them, but trying to get what I can information-wise from them. But
got it. Let me remind everybody, this is Behind the Headlines on WLIW. I'm Joe Shaw. My co-host is Bill Sutton. We're with the Express News Group. Our panelists this week are Beth Young of the East End Beacon and Denise Civiletti and Alec Lewis from the Riverhead Local. So let's move on. Beth, I wanted to talk about, you sent me a note and said seaplanes on the North Fork.
Okay.
And that, well, that caught my attention. I was curious about what you're talking about there.
Well, seaplanes are not supposed to land on the North Fork. Mm. I believe not in Riverhead either. Is that?
I believe that is correct. Yes.
Yeah. So Riverhead, East Hampton, and Southampton Town do not allow seaplanes to land in their waters. But this seaplane company from Florida called Tropic Ocean Airways started this public relations campaign in late August, saying they'll take you directly to a few waterfront restaurants on the North Fork and on Shelter Island, restaurants and oyster farms. And you can experience this great experience from going from, I think, the Hudson River to Peconic Bay. The only thing is they are either flouting or unaware that this is not legal in the town of Southold. So Southold Town Supervisor Al Krupski says, if you see them, call the police. Wow. One of the restaurants they wanted to land at is called Minnow at the Galley Ho in New Suffolk, which is this right on the Peconic Bay. It's one of the was the first submarine base in the United States. Very tiny little community. Our office is actually right across from this beach where the seaplane landed. Our neighbors tell us at least three occasions in the last couple months. And nobody really thought about it because the property they landed on actually belongs to the owner of Robbins Island, who has a seaplane. And he has a permit for a dock on the island so he can access his island. He's like the only person who's allowed because he's not beaching it. He's bringing it to his dock. And it's for personal use. So Suffolk County actually has a water taxi law that you have to get a county license to run what this would be considered a water taxi.
Where are they coming from, Beth?
They're coming from Manhattan. I'm not sure which body of water. I don't know if it's the Hudson or the East River, but.
So they I'm showing, to be a journalist, sometimes you have to show your ignorance here. I believe some of those seaplanes were landing at East Hampton Airport for a while on the runways, right? They were coming from the waters of Manhattan and coming out to East Hampton. I think that was something that was happening for a time.
That's possible.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know anything about it. So
only when it was raining.
Only when it was raining.
Yes.
So, and you know, it's different if it's like, you know, a regularly scheduled thing with passengers for hire. The Southold Town Supervisor's big point that he made was that, you know, this spot where they were landing in New Suffolk is, there's a lot of recreational boat traffic out there. There's people on paddleboards, there's people on kayaks, there's people swimming, there's people taking their dogs on paddleboards. There's a lot of little boats. There's a little sailing school right there with little JY sailing with really little kids out learning how to sail.
Goodness.
So
that has some dangerous potential.
Yeah. So this is not allowed to happen in Southland, but the Pridwin on Shelter Island is still partnering with them. So you have to go to Shelter Island if you want this experience. I guess it's still allowed there. But this did raise quite a ruckus in New Suffolk because, Southold had adopted this law in 2022. And the head of the town's aircraft noise advisory committee said, you know, this particular operator has been skirting South Old Town Law for a while, and actually the law was beefed up 3 years ago in anticipation that they were going to try and do this.
Wow.
And they have.
Interesting.
So I don't know if the fight will continue. They've taken down all their promotional materials. The restaurant in New Suffolk had a arrive by plane tab on their website that they've really? Taken down. So I guess.
I imagine they're exceptionally noisy.
They're quite noisy. They're turboprop Cessna Grand Caravans, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Interesting. I don't know what the person who owns Robbins Island thinks of them landing on his property yet. We're waiting to hear.
Yes. So, okay, I want to talk also about a story that we had, Bill, about a field, about an 8-acre field in Sagaponack Village that's owned by Southampton Town. And it's basically known locally as Ponquag Field because it's not Ponquag, I'm sorry, Poxabog. I live in Hampton Bays, which is Ponquag. Poxabog is Sagaponack. It's Poxabog Field. It's about 8 acres of former farmland, and it's been preserved by the town. What's interesting now is the discussion is it was meant to be preserved, and the family that bought the field and then sold it to the town for preservation wanted it to be preserved in perpetuity as farmland. But in the last several years, it has sat fallow. It's turned into a meadow, which now a lot of people in Sagaponack are saying, we would much rather leave it as a fallow meadow and leave it in its natural state and just leave it preserved as that. Not everybody agrees with that.
I don't know if it's a lot of people. There seems to be a pretty healthy debate mm-hmm. between those that want it maintained as as agricultural use. The fear being that if the town buys property, preserves it as farmland, and then changes its mind later on, that's a dangerous precedent, that would prevent future farmland owners from selling either farmland or rights to their property that they want to see preserved as farmland.
Yeah, and I believe Sagaponack Village has chimed in on this, and the village itself, this is within the village, although it's owned by the town, and it's really going to be up to the town to decide what to do here. But Sagaponack Village has actually voted and said they want it to be a farm field, and the mayor of Sagaponack himself is a farmer by trade.
Yeah,
and he's made the point he says that there's somebody ready to farm it, but if it's going to be turned into a farm field, there would need to be fences erected because certainly the problem with deer in Sagaponack is pretty significant, and that ends up being a matter of debate among neighbors too, who aren't big fans of the fences.
Absolutely. And I mean, and the town has been working with Peconic Land Trust to try to lease the property out, but as you said, it's been difficult. There's ecological sensitivity issues with that area, and then scenic and drainage easements that were put into place that would have to put into place when the property was subdivided that would still need to be adhered to. That would be difficult if it was an operational farm.
You kind of hinted at it too, that part of the conversation here is it was originally preserved as farmland. Yeah. And if you decide to change directions with the CPF, it can be a dangerous thing because people may be less willing to sell lands and preserve it if they feel like that preservation isn't going to be permanent.
When you have property owners that are selling their properties or the rights, development rights on their properties, for less money sometimes than they could get from private developers. They have to have a partnership with a town that they're going to trust. And I think that if you start changing the conditions after the fact, then the town would lose some credibility, moving forward with property owners that that want to do the right thing, that want to preserve their property. But if they feel that they could get more money from a developer and the town's not going to keep its word anyway about preserving the property, why wouldn't they cash in?
The other voice that comes into play here is some of the environmental community. I know folks from the Long Pond Greenbelt, in particular, the Friends of the Long Pond Greenbelt, have said that they would prefer to see it stay as in its natural state, you know, for environmental reasons too, that farming can be problematic when it comes to the water table, and that they would rather see at least some of the land in Sagaponack State stay in its natural state.
Well, you've got Dave Dayton there from that organization who, you know, who was quoted at a meeting saying that it should never have been designated for agricultural use because of its location within the Greenbelt watershed area. Mm-hmm. That it should have been preserved to help, you know, that environmental sensitive.
It seems areas. Like it could be a site for some kind of permaculture project.
Hmm.
If but you got to find somebody who's like interested in doing, 'cause that's sort of like growing things that are really part of the native environment. But there aren't a lot of farmers around here who do that kind of thing because the land value is so enormous compared to other places you could farm. But
there you go. And
it'd be a great demonstration, and it would kind of get around that.
It's the discussion is so interesting because it's about whether or not preserved land should just be. I mean, when we're preserving land out here, it's either open space or farmland. But it just goes to show you those two things are very different. And you've got to decide which way to go with some of these properties. And in Sagaponack especially, there are still a lot of farmland. There isn't a lot of natural space left. There's been a lot of land preserved as farmland. But
there's also a lot of fallow farmland on the east end. And
mm-hmm.
it's so hard to be a farmer.
There's been some discussion about maybe finding a middle ground and maybe planting some field crops that are, you know, less about, you know, trying to keep it more like a less than a working field and more like a natural space. So debate's going to keep going on, and I suspect it's going to go on for a while because the sides are pretty dug in. But speaking of debates, we are just about out of time here. So I want to thank everybody who's on our panel. That's Beth Young of the East End Beacon, Denise Civiletti of Riverhead Local, and Alec Lewis of Riverhead Local. But we have to say congratulations to Alec. Next time he's on the show, he will be representing Newsday. Congratulations, Alec.
I don't know about that. I might come on as Riverhead Local before I join Newsday on September 29th.
Fair enough.
So we'll see what happens.
We'll have you back.
If you say you're Riverhead Local, we won't tell anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you to you guys, and thank you to my co-host, Bill Sutton. I'm Joe Shaw, and we will be back next time with another edition of Behind the Headlines. Thanks, guys.